This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin. With me this week are two people that I love to talk about comic books with, Nick White.
Hey.
And Kate Scotchless.
Hello.
Thank you both for joining me this week. I'm really excited to talk about comics. I've done nothing but read comics for the last 4 or 5 days. Like, it's every night. I've been staying up way too late reading comic books, so I hope that you two are ready for me to go absolutely insane. But let me ask you the question that I'm going to ask you, that I always ask. How have you been, and how have comic books been? Nick, I'm going to throw this to you first.
Sure. You know, some of you might wonder where I've been for the last couple weeks. Some of you might not care. That's totally understandable. I would probably endorse that mentality. Yeah, my sister had the nerve to go and get married, which, inconsiderate on her part. She doesn't look at the schedule. We have a shared schedule in our family. You know, we plan events. I have a podcast. She wanted to get married, and apparently people are just jerks. I'm just going to leave it at that, okay? That might be me. So things have been really, really busy, and also you'd be surprised how quickly you get blacklisted when you say mean things about Gambit. Some people just can't take jokes.
So touchy.
You know,
this is my podcast, Nick. This is my damn podcast.
You know, he might be a raging Cajun, but I will tell you that Mike Rappin is just as angry of an individual. He is not my moan and me.
You know that I am on this episode with you, right?
Fuck. All right, Xander, everything about Mike, cut it, including Mike. No, things have been busy, but I've been reading a lot, which is good. I finally finished Divinity. Divinity for me was one of those, I should say Divinity 2, was one of those things where I think a lot of people were talking about it when it wrapped, and I just wasn't ready to finish the book at that point. So I was like, I've got to let this die down and basically hide before I finish this book or it's going to get ruined. But it was a really sentimental ending. It was a really good kind of meditation on what it means to feel like a man out of place, a man out of time, sort of the ability to let go of things. And God, I'm not certain if I totally understood the final page of this book. So anyone who's read it, we need to talk because I'm not so certain I got it. Beyond that, I did try another Rebirth number one in Blue Beetle. I sort of told myself I was kind of done with this character, especially when I found out that they're like, hey, did you like the Blue Beetle from New 52 where DC actually attempted to inject some diversity into one of their series and actually let that series nearly run to 20 issues? Whoops, how did that happen? and then they were like, hey, let's really hedge our bets, and we'll give you that Blue Beetle in Jaime Reyes, but we'll also give you rich, billionaire, white, old Blue Beetle, Ted Kord, and we'll throw them together. And I'm like, okay. And they're like, yeah, and Dr. Fate's going to be in this book, too. I'm like, what, why? Yeah, and he's going to reveal something crazy about Blue Beetle that's going to change the shape of this book forever. And I'm like, what? What's going on here? But the team on this book is great. You got Keith Given writing it, and Keith Given, for me, is probably the closest you're going to get these days in a lot of ways to Jack Kirby. Given was the one who drew OMAC in the New 52. It's goofy. Ted Kord totally comes off as a huge freaking dork with more money than he knows what to do with. And he's like, we really need to study this beetle. And Jaime is like, I need to fucking go to school. Like, you're a weird dude. And like, he's like paging him in between classes, and he's like, dude, something just went off in the beetle copter. He's like, you like the beetle copter, right, kid? It's our bat cave. And Jaime's like, fuck it. Like, I have to be at class. I can't fail. And Ted is like, yeah, no one cares, kid. No one cares. So a lot of fun, really goofy. I'm actually going to be continuing that. It's got Scott Collins on art, who is kind of polarizing. He's done some Flash art. He also recently drew all of Matt Kent's series Pastaways. I also read Alien 19, which was drawn by Richard Corbin, horror comics master, if you will. But the big book I want to talk about is Bloodshot Reborn 16. We're nearly at the end of the arc of Bloodshot Island, and like, honest to fucking God, this book is basically Hunger Games meets Multiplicity meets Groundhog's Day meets Predator, all thrown into one. You've got all these different bloodshots that are on an island, which is why the arc is called Bloodshot Island. They did a great job of very front and center declaring what the fuck is going on. It's an island of bloodshots. What do you want? And you've got Vietnam Bloodshot, and you've got World War II Bloodshot, and Cold War Bloodshot, and a very cute dog named Bloodhound, who the little red dot on him is actually the little metal, whatever you want to call it, on his collar. You know, it's his little metal tag on his collar is a red dot. So that's sort of Bloodhound's red dot, even though Bloodhound is not a bloodhound, oddly enough, which is good because bloodhounds are not like scary looking dogs.
Right.
Tomorrow you'll read about Nick White getting attacked by a bloodhound. I can just sense it already. Anyway, it's super bizarre, and every day these guys are released on this island and they've got an armory and they basically grab all their weapons and they go out and they're being forced to fight this thing called Deathmate. And every day Deathmate kills them, and every day they wake up in the bunker again. And it reminds me a lot of what was that movie like, Live, Die, Repeat or whatever, the one with Tom
Edge
Cruise.
Of Tomorrow?
Edge of Tomorrow. Edge of Tomorrow. Is it Edge of Tomorrow, I think?
Yeah. Well, every time he gets killed, he wakes up in the same spot and he has to retrain.
Yeah, this is definitely not a type of movie I would have seen, sorry.
Okay.
You lost me at Tom Cruise.
Sure. Well, it's him and Emily Blunt, and it's actually a fantastic science fiction film that I would actually recommend in spite of it being Tom Cruise. So.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, it's a great book, and it really plays into Valiant's long game because there are issues with this character of Deathmate that were buried all the way back at the end of like 2014, and now they're finally coming to a head. So,
oh geez.
But that's what I read. What about you, Kate?
I basically just read everything that I pulled this week, and then one volume of Star Wars. So I got Mockingbird number 7, which is another Civil War tie-in, and it's glorious. And they're still on this kind of comics convention cruise ship, and there's been a murder, and it was the guy. Never mind, I'm not going to say who it was because that would be a total spoiler.
Don't spoil it.
See how I found myself there? You're welcome, people.
That was good.
Yeah, anyway, we're trying to figure out what happened, and things are becoming more clear, and it's fabulous and snarky and everything you want it to be. I also got Faith number 3 with Jody Hauser, Our Gift from the Lord. It was so good. It's Archer and Faith go to a con. Am I sensing a theme here? Maybe. Maybe not.
Maybe.
Anyway, stuff gets stolen. They want to help. This comic was absolutely delightful because I think I wouldn't have enjoyed it as much if I hadn't read any Archer and Armstrong before. So thank you, Nick, for that, for, you know, showing me the light.
I was going to ask how approachable, you know, it was. And
it still would have been fun, but I don't think the cracks, like the jokes with Archer, wouldn't have been as funny if you didn't get why he would. Yeah, exactly. You'd just be like, why does he have such a stick of his butt?
he's so formal. What's going on?
That's right. What's so weird. And so, yeah, so she like dresses him up. It's his first con, and he's basically dressed up as like Legolas. And although we can't actually say that because, you know, copyrights. But
legal reasons, sure.
Right. Sure. He's a legally distinct elf, people, okay? So anyway, and he's all upset because they won't let him take in real weapons, and what's he supposed to do with these fake ones? And,
right.
And the other cosplayers are super into him because they're like, you're so good at staying in character. Like, so it's, yeah, it was good and just fun. Both Faith and Mockingbird are just, you know, fun, light kind of things. I also read All-Star Batman number 2, which I was not as into. I think if I knew more of the Batverse and especially the villains that were showing up, I would be into it. But as it is in this issue, like 10 different villains show up and I knew like one of them. So right. I'm just like, right. This would be cool if I knew these people, but I don't care enough. And especially with the price point, I'm just like, yeah, I'll look for this in trade when it comes to the library.
It's always kind of interesting that usually one of the Bat books sort of turns into more of a how should I put this? Like a laundry list. Hardcore reader, you know, book. Like this is the one for people that have been around forever. You know, it feels like there's one of those. And I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing or that that book is inherently good or bad. Just that usually there's one Batman book that's more like, this is where the weird shit goes.
Yeah.
Right.
This is where the villain from 1972 goes. Yeah, yeah.
You definitely don't, it's not written in such a way that you don't get what's going on without knowing the people. It's just that it's not right. That cool if you don't know the people. Like, it's definitely explained sure. Even who each person is, like, within the little, you know, subcaptions of who it is and what their power is, and basically, but it ends up feeling very laundry list if this isn't an exciting person for you to see show up. You're just like, yeah. Oh, and here's another one, and here's another one. And
another one.
I really like the art style on it, I think, is interesting. It's the kind you don't usually see Batman in, so that was fun. But like I said, that's going to end up getting from the library. On the flip side, Animosity was so wonderful that it's getting added to my regular pull. Tia talked about it last week, and everything she said is true. Listen to her. If you didn't listen to her, go back and listen to that episode, because there's a lot and I don't want to rehash it. But
I like that. Kate, look at Kate right here, just naturally plugging other episodes and basically like holding opinions hostage. Do you want to know what I thought? Well, it's what Tia thought, and Tia said it on the last
episode.
That's
right. So, you have to listen. It's like a really
Nick
aggressive
White
editor's
stepped in
note.
And just ruined this totally organic segue and stomped all over it.
Who's this? Well, check out Superman number 37.
Yes.
I'm not even going to say who I am on this podcast. You're going to have to go listen to a different one.
My
anyway, it's wonderful. And then I also read Star Wars Volume 3, Rebel Jail. I read this while waiting for the Nick White at Barnes & Noble's because he was late. And so I was there for like an hour, and I made great friends with a tiny nerd. And we discussed the Star Wars comics at length. And that's how you make friends, guys. Was his mom there? Yeah, definitely.
Oh, when you said tiny nerd.
Oh,
I
yeah.
See.
I mean, a child nerd. He was super
okay.
cute.
Okay.
Like, as an adorable cute, not, yeah. So, and he was, like, all whiny with his mom trying to get her to buy him this $60 omnibus. I'm like, oh, you go for it, kid. Just,
oh, my goodness.
Just go for it. But, Mom, it'll take me, like, a whole week to read it.
Oh, my goodness.
Don't listen to what the people say about Mark Millar, Mom. He's a flawed genius.
Yeah, I need this omnibus of kick-ass. Come on.
I saw the movie. You let me see the movie,
oh,
Mom.
Oh, my goodness.
All my friends are reading it. Yeah. So,
Star Wars Rebel Jail was good then? Is that what you're saying?
It was. It was great. I just wanted to throw in there that Volume 2, like, Volume 1 was fantastic, and Volume 2 was, like, it was really good, and I enjoyed it, but it wasn't like, oh, my God, tell all your friends, this is so great. And so I was pleasantly surprised when Volume 3 was right back to that, oh, my God, tell all your friends, this is amazing kind of stuff. So
that's cool.
Yep. How about you, Mike?
Yeah, this week, like I said, I read a lot of comics. I've been flying through a bunch of manga because that's what I do with my free time now. But I won't talk about manga on the show. Instead, I will talk about the actual, you know, the Western comics that I read. I did read my pick of the week from last week, Jonesy number 6. It's a continuation into the world of a teenage girl who lives on the internet and also real life. And we get to witness that. It's fun. It's cute. I said enough about this last week. I also read All-Star Batman number 2. And unlike Kate, I didn't mind all of the name dropping and all of the weird descriptions because I read Transformers vs. G.I. Joe. And if you read Transformers vs. G.I. Joe,
yeah.
That is 90% of that comic. A character shows up on one page and you're very lucky if they show up on another, but you always get a little box that says who they are and what they do. It's awesome. So I've learned to roll with those punches. So if you want a book that will train you to just kind of deal with things as they're thrown at you, that's a great book. It's also a fun, entertaining read. So go read Transformers vs. G.I. Joe. But nonetheless, I too am going to be switching to trades for this. I think I like Scott Snyder's writing a lot. But since I've also been reading the Batman series, like his New 52 run, I've been reading that in trade. I've actually enjoyed reading his work in collected volumes, and I think that's what I'm going to continue to do with All-Star Batman. I think he tells a much greater ongoing like chunk of a story rather than a serialized month-to-month story, so I think I'm just going to move over to that. I don't have too much to complain really about John Romita's art in comparison to Declan Shelby anymore. I actually like the way that they're kind of taking the character. They have that. They still have that iconic new Batman design that I love in Tom King's book that he's doing.
Yes.
And like that's probably the biggest selling point I can say about all this. All this Rebirth Batman stuff. His costume is my favorite of any
that,
costume,
like,
I think.
That gold outline on the suit.
Yeah.
Ugh,
it just, it slays me. And to the defense of this book, I think that what Tom King is do, or I'm sorry, what Scott Snyder is doing with Two-Face right now is really cool. I just don't think I have the patience to wait every month. I'd rather just read this in one go. So if you're buying this month to month, that's awesome. You should continue to do so, but I'm going to be switching over to trade. So
you heard it here first. Mike Rappin, comma, Kate Scotchless, colon, want Scott Snyder, homeless, comma, potentially, on the streets.
Yes.
I just wanted to put that out there.
He has said so many times that the vast majority of what he's made has come from Witches versus any of his DC books.
I don't know. I don't know if I believe that. I know he's mentioned in the past, and a lot of writers have, that Image contracts have the potential to be more lucrative, but I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't
wrong,
think he'd lie to us, Nick. He's
if he's
a
writing,
wonderful, beautiful
if you're writing
guy.
The number one, like, top selling, although that might be JL, but I doubt it. If you're writing the number one DC book, even if DC has a penchant to maybe screw you over in some capacity, I don't know if I'd believe that the number one DC book would make
you,
less money.
You think
than,
he would
hey,
lie?
You know, yeah. We can ask
Why
Scott Snyder another time. We don't know. There's no need to pontificate on this, on yeah. someone's actual money. I don't want to do that. But anyways, other Scott Snyder books that I've been reading. I did read Batman Volume 6 from the New 52 Graveyard Shift, which is a series of one-shots or one-off issues. There's like a Scott Snyder working with some, like either by himself or with another writer to create a story. So like Gary Dugan was in there, Margaret Bennett was in there, James Tynion was in there. There was a lot of reaction to the death of Robin, and there was a nice issue all about the individual Robins, which I thought was kind of sweet. I don't know where this falls in the timeline of Damian actually dying in the New 52, but it seemed like it was this volume. They just wanted to react to it, so that was cool. But I am looking forward to reading Endgame next, if only because I want to read more of a continuous story, and I'm really done with Zero Year. So, like a lot of people were when it came out. But finally, I read Chew Volume 10, Choose the Best. There's nothing more to say than that. I'm really excited for this book to end, if only to sit down and reread the entire series when Volume 12 comes out.
Down with a big, big thing of food and just eat and
yeah,
read
I will
Chew
have,
and definitely
like,
not throw up.
I will eat a whole chicken for every volume of Chew that there is. no, that's insane.
You know, but this podcast is legally binding, right? You have to do that now.
I forgot that we changed that this week. but finally, I did read Doom Patrol number 1 that came out this past week. And boy, oh boy, I don't know if I'm supposed to understand this book. I don't know if I like this book. I don't know if I want to continue to read this book because there was so much weirdness and uncertainty that came out of the entire story. I feel like longtime Doom Patrol fans probably love this, and someone that knows nothing about the Doom Patrol at all, has never read a Doom Patrol thing, has only heard people talk about it, I was lost. I didn't know who anyone was. We only got little pieces of information about them, and maybe there's supposed to be more. Like, maybe I'm making a really strong snap judgment on a first issue, which is something we say we shouldn't do a lot of the times on this show. So I'm going to give it a second issue, but Gerard Way, his writing is kind of, it's very, very well constructed. I just was missing pieces. Like, I just want a little more background on people. So hopefully the next issue will get that. But Nick Darrington's art is wonderful. It's beautiful. It's on the same level as a lot of other artists who do like this very almost pop arty style, kind of like a Mike Allred or a the artist who is on Doc Shiner.
Reminded me a little
almost.
Bit of They're Not Like Us in some ways, even.
Yeah, I could see
Simon
that a little
Gain.
Bit. Yeah.
You're right, though. It's a little cleaner like Shiner, though. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would agree with that. Shiner or Steve the Dude Rude. Steve the Dude Rude, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to give the next issue another shot, but chances are this might be a book that moves over to trade for me because trying to keep up with all these new 52, or excuse me, the Rebirth books has been pretty daunting, and I'm I'm scared. I don't want to try to keep like all of this continuity in my head. I'd rather just read it in one big go. So I don't know. All the reviews that I've seen online are mostly praising this book. So I don't know what to say. I feel like I'm an outsider, or I just don't know enough about DC to actually enjoy this book.
Mike, are you trying to say that, like, to me, you're saying, at least what I'm hearing is, like, I'm not okay, I promise? Is that what I'm hearing about this Gerard Way title? And that maybe if it doesn't sell well, these will be his famous last words? Are these...
Nick,
am I picking up?
I'm so mad at you right now. Don't you dare quote My Chemical Romance at me on this show.
Look, if that's this is what you want, if you wanted honesty, that's all you had to say, Mike.
Oh my God! Okay, we're moving on. We're moving into our comic picks because, damn it, Nick, I'm so mad at you right now. You were able to fit in way too many My Chemical Romance lyrics into that sentence. Comic books come out this week on September 21st. Nick, I'm going to throw it back to you. What are you reading? What are you excited for this upcoming week?
For me, I'd have to say my big pick for this week is Britannia, number one. It's another one of these Valiant books of this new, gosh, what is Valiant calling this wave? I think last year it was called, like, Valiant Next. I think this wave is called Future of Valiant. And it's got some very increasingly weird books that are placed in odd time periods and whatnot that you're like, how are they going to stitch all of this together? Maybe they won't. But with Britannia, you've got Peter Milligan on writing, who for me is kind of a bit of a crapshoot. He's a real mainstay in the comic book industry, but I'll level with you. Some of his stuff was fine. Other times... I had no problem with him being pulled off of Justice League Dark with the New 52 very quickly. That was fine in my book. So you've got him, and you've got Juan Jose Reap on art, and it follows this guy called Antonius Axia during the era of the Roman Empire in 65 AD. And he's been sent by the Roman Empire to go investigate some strange happenings out in one of their far-flung colonies, a.k.a. Britannia, because that's what you had to name the book after, right?
Right.
So that's that. Milligan says, quote, I see the story as a kind of gladiator meets druid era alien. And alien, of course, I'm referring to the movie. I realize that's the one problem whenever you mention alien, people are like, generic aliens? No, italicized with a capital A, alien, that one. So whatever the fuck that means, I don't really know. I never thought druid and xenomorph would be in the same sentence, more or less, but here we go. It's going to be a miniseries.
Hey, there's a whole show on the History Channel, so you know it's true.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell me that there were already fanfics about druids and xenomorphs.
Oh, come on, Nick.
I'm like woefully out of touch.
But also, it's an idea. That whole ancient aliens show.
Yeah, aliens, right?
There's a great meme, guys. A great meme.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. Because, like, for me, honestly, like, Juan Jose Reap's art is a huge sell here. But the bottom line is, how is this going to be roped into anything remotely Valiant? Because the only common thread that you can usually stitch everything together with is Eternal Warrior, so maybe? I'm just going to make a prediction. I think this is going to get somehow intertwined with Eternal Warrior. So there you have it.
That dude is in everything, though.
Yeah, well, you know, there are perks to being immortal, so...
Yeah, kinda.
Immortal time hopper, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's Ivar.
That's his other brother.
Oh, whoops. Just
come on.
Kidding. Shows what
I know. This is Gilead Anipata, not Ivar Anipata. Come on, Kate. I'm just kidding.
I'm so ashamed. I'm going to go off my shame corner now.
No, I can't keep track of it either. I just kind of nod and say yes to Nick a lot and just assume that he's right. So, Kate, what are you excited for this upcoming week?
This week, I'm excited for Vote Loki number 4. The tagline of which is Ragnarok the Vote, which I thought was hilarious. This is written by Christopher Hastings, and it's a prime example of how one really good person on a book can make up for others that are weaker. My usual example of this is the Elektra run with Del Mundo on art, and how the art was so pretty that you could forget maybe for a little while that the writing was super bad.
Yes.
And this is the opposite, where the writing is so good you don't mind the other stuff. And that being said, this art might definitely be for some people. It's just a super stylized, kind of very distinctive art that I'm not a huge fan of, but I could definitely see where other people might be really into it. So this comic is basically a commentary on Trumpism.
Oh, good.
And the media's role in his rise and all that stuff. The main character is a reporter who... So Loki has come and he's running for president. And at first, everyone's like, oh, it's a joke. This is not a real thing. And, you know, it follows the rise of Trump. And so the main character is a reporter who's trying to expose him, show all the ways that he's really not this reformed, you know, good guy that he now says he is and all this stuff. And she keeps getting frustrated by the fact that every time she exposes something, it's spun in such a way in the media, like he spins it in the way in the media that ends up helping him. So like within the same 24-hour news cycle, it's like, oh, this ends him. You know, no one in the right mind would vote for him anymore. The TV people are saying. And then by the time her plane lands, they're all like, and now he's shot ahead in the polls because this, what we thought was a bad thing, is actually this good thing he says, and, you know, that kind of stuff. And is there really anything he could do to lose votes? Probably not.
Oh, boy.
It is. It sounds like, oh, God, why would I want more of this? Because it's so hard listening to stuff as it is. But it's actually fun and insightful, and it takes the sting out a little bit of real life. It's one of those kind of soothing commentaries versus, I don't want to say soothing, it's comedic. I don't know. I really, really enjoy it, and I didn't think I would. Like, I came to this because a friend, I think when issue 2 came out, he was like, this is awesome, are you reading this? And I'm like, I had flipped through it, and like I said, the art wasn't super appealing to me. And I'm like, oh, this sounds kind of eh. And I'm not a huge... Like, I don't mind Loki. It's not, like, a character I don't like, but I'm not, like, a super fan. So right. A standalone series was not typically something that I'd pick up. But then I read the first one. I was like, this is awesome. So
is this the last issue of the series? Or is it an ongoing?
No, it's an ongoing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, cool. At least as far as I know. I guess I haven't really checked, but I've not ever seen anything that says, you know, of 7 or something like that.
Right, I figure with Ragnarok the vote, that's kind of implying things. But cool, that sounds cool. We will probably talk a little bit more about that after we do our break. But for me, what I'm excited for this upcoming week, and this may come as a shocker because I've actually got a very big pull list this week, but I'm going to try something new, and I'm going to try something that kind of shocks myself. I'm going to be buying 7 to Eternity number 1 by Rick Remender and Jeremy Opina. And I feel like I'm setting myself up for failure a little bit because this is like one of those really wild and out there crazy stories that Rick Remender has like a really cool premise for, and I'm worried that it's going to fail, but except...
That doesn't happen.
But you know, that there's a chance. I really like Jeremy Opina's art. This is a mini series, so I mean, we're going to have to cut right to the punch. We're going to have to get into the story right away. And for that, I'm willing to take a risk. I'm willing to try a number one and say, hey, let's see if Rick Remender can win me back into his good graces. It's not like he's really trying for me specifically, but I figure, you know, you can only crap on someone so much without, you know, actually trying their work again and saying, hey, you know, reassuring yourself, yes, this is as bad as I thought it was going to be. So I'm going to try it. I don't have high hopes, but, you know, there's a chance with a miniseries that I may get sucked in and dig this. Plus, I'm not going to really turn down Jeremy Opina's art. His stuff is way, way too good. If you get a chance to look at the previews for this book, it looks
what
beautiful.
What publisher is it?
Image. This is being published through
okay.
Image, yeah.
Okay.
So hopefully it'll be good.
I will give Rick Remender some major credit, and I guess maybe the best credit I can give him is sort of a backhanded compliment, but I guess take it, because here it comes.
That's all you're going to get.
That sounds weird. Yeah. No, like, there obviously are a bunch of polarizing writers out there, and the thing is, with some of them, they make a point of pairing themselves with artists that I don't like either, and that makes not reading their books so much easier. Rick Remender, on the flip side, I'll tell you what, this guy's fucking brilliant. I don't really like Deadly Class, but he paired himself with Wes Craig. I mean, come on. And Lowe has Greg Tocchini. Tokyo Ghost had Sean Murphy. So yeah, I mean, Mike's completely spot on. Like, what is the deal with Remender nonstop grabbing all of these fucking amazing artists? And it's a genius point, because there are people out there who don't love his writing, but he put himself with Sean Murphy, and I was like, I have to go look at the Constitution, but I think I'm actually legally obligated to buy this book now. Yeah, kudos to you, Recommender. I realize that wasn't the most nice thing to say, but I think there was a compliment in there, even if it wasn't
he can identify
for you.
Good art.
Even if it wasn't for you. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I mean, I realize I didn't give the premise to this book when I pitched it, which is what kind of sold me. It's this weird thing where there are people who are from like a powerful house, they have to fight gods, and it's going to be very grand in scale, and like Opinia's art really lends to that kind of stuff.
Work on before this, Mike? I know the name, but I can't place it with anything.
If I'm not mistaken, he worked on Rick Remender's Uncanny X-Force when that was being published, and the art in that book is unbelievably good. So I'm really hoping that we're going to see some of more Opinia's crazier stuff in this. And now I'm like frantically Googling to make sure that I've got this all right. At the same time, like this, I'm certain that as a miniseries, this book will probably do well, and I will probably get sucked in and really, really like it. And you know, by the seventh issue, it'll be done, so I don't have to feel disappointed after the first arc. But I'm really excited to try this at least. It's something to say, like, I'm trying a new number one. I'm trying something that's probably got a lot of hype around it, and I can actually jump on the bandwagon rather than waiting for two or three issues to come out and hearing everyone go, Mike, are you reading this book? And then I go, well, no. You know, doing that thing because I'm so high up in my own ass that I think I'm better than everyone. So
Xander won't even have to cut that together to make you say that. I mean, you just went ahead and just threw it right out
there.
Let me just be brutally honest, you know, I'm way up my ass about comic books, guys.
So, several months ago, when Mike Rappin did his semi-annual, oh my god, we're almost out of topics, guys, help.
I'm not that desperate.
I brainstormed some topics, and one of them that I threw out there was politics and comics, and what that is, and what's good and what's bad, and what do we think about these things. And so I think to start our conversation, we need to obviously define what we mean by politics and comics. So I'm going to throw out there the definition of politics is any activities associated with the governance of a country or other area, especially debate or conflict among individuals or parties, having or hoping to achieve power. So I specifically don't mean like one of my big pet peeves is like, oh, is there a minority character that was given a mantle? Why do we have to make put politics in it? I'm like, no. Someone's existence isn't political. Having an LGBTQ character doesn't mean it's a political comic. That
right.
Existence doesn't mean it's political. We specifically mean the struggle between communities of people. So that could be countries. It can also be types of heroes. We see that a lot with like the X-Men. And so I feel like we get this a lot more than people really realize, because a lot of people think of politics strictly as government stuff. And really, it's stories of contemporary power struggles are inherently stories of politics. So there are issues of things like who gets to make the rules, regulations, and decisions, who gets to have a voice in those decisions, and who do we follow and support, and who should have control. And it's all tied into issues of fairness and morality and autonomy, and these are really important and deep and big issues, and sometimes they're dealt with in really shallow ways in comics, like Hulk Smash, which can be super fun and satisfying, but sometimes they can be dealt with in really nuanced ways as well. In both, we see politics in comics that are nonfiction or based on true stories, and we also see it in a lot of fictional comics. So from there, I know both of you guys had brainstormed quite a lot of stuff that you'd read that you liked and wanted to bring up, so throwing it back to you guys.
Yeah, we started talking about this idea of politics and comics. The first thing that I had thought of, and Kate, you had mentioned earlier you read Vote Loki, so that's like a clear, mm-hmm. obvious, you know, piece of this.
Oh yeah, that's super obvious, yeah.
But like, the first thing that came to mind to me, for me at least, was there was a series of really weird comic books that came out around the 2008 election, I believe. And for instance, there's a steampunk Sarah Palin comic about Sarah Palin as this adventurer who lives in a steampunk world. I didn't read it. There's an article on Comics Alliance all about it.
Maybe you didn't, but I think I'm about to.
Yeah. Jeez, this sounds fantastic. And it's so bizarre because there are these.
As long as she stays there.
Well, there are these. Yeah. Well, it wasn't just her. It was like Barack Obama had a series about him being like this Conan the Barbarian type character. And there was a John McCain
like vaguely one. Racist. But.
No, it wasn't anything like that. It was like, but still, like, I mean, there's a whole Wikipedia page about Barack Obama in comic books that I'm gonna click open right now because, you know, Barack Obama, for instance, showed up in Captain America. He showed up in Spider-Man. There was a whole issue about Barack Obama showing up in New York City, and Spider-Man has to help him. And they did like a mocking issue later of that when Stephen Colbert showed up. But Barack Obama's been in a bunch of things and referenced as a character, and you see his likeness.
He's even been in DC books, even though DC, I think Marvel is more willing to wade into that like presidency stuff more than DC, but Barack Obama was still in Justice League of America when Martian Manhunter was one of his like Secret Service guards.
Yeah.
And he was in Forever Evil Argus, which is basically S.H.I.E.L.D. for DC, and Steve Trevor had to like rescue the president when all of these villains were running around. So yeah, there's something interesting to be said about how present Barack Obama has been in comics versus other presidents.
Right. And but back to what I was originally talking about, there were these just weird books about these presidential candidates at the time, and they were just absurd. And it wasn't trying to like politicize anything, but it was just like, here's a weird story that has this character's or this person's likeness in it. It was kind of just absurd. So when we were talking about politics and comics, that's of course what came to mind. But then when I actually sat down to think about it, I realized, you know, one of the biggest books that I own that I love a lot is Transmetropolitan by Warren Ellis and Derek, whose name I'm blanking on, I want to say Robertson, but I think that's wrong.
The guy from The Boys.
I believe so. Nonetheless,
that'd be him, then.
So yeah. This is like a very long story about one man's gonzo journalism trying to out various political problems in the city that he lives in. It's called The City, and it's this massive metropolis where everyone lives and everyone can have powers, or they can get drugs for anything, and then everything's automated and it's wild and crazy. If you haven't read this book, it's fantastic. But one of the core tenets of this book is the main character, Spider Jerusalem. He had outed a previous president and like covered him immensely on his rise to power, and it didn't work out. So Spider Jerusalem leaves the city. There, he comes back to the city when he hears about this new election. I mean, that's not actually the story, but he comes back while there's this new election happening, and you watch various political figures grow, and it's about Spider Jerusalem outing people for their corruption and how they are not actually true to the people. And it's fantastic because you root for that character so hard because you, as a person who would want to see this, would want to have a, you know, person in power that you can trust. You're like, I'm so glad to see that he is outing these people. And I won't spoil the story, but there are just some fantastic moments with Spider Jerusalem covering all of this and talking about it. And on top of all the wild and crazy other shit that's happening. But like, that's one of the books that I think of. Along with Brian K. Vaughan's work that he's done, which is Ex Machina, which is all about a guy who was actually the mayor of New York City. He just happened to have superpowers at one point. So like, when I think of politics and comics, I go directly to these types of books because they are so blatantly about politics in one way or another. But I don't ever think about something like X-Men being political because it's just, in my mind, I'm so biased. I'm like, well, the X-Men are always being persecuted, so like, root for them because the government's always coming down on them, or Magneto is, or someone else is always trying to, you know, hurt them or trying to get rid of them, and they're the underdog constantly. So I don't know.
Right, they're the repressed group, which is totally and it becomes frequently a political power struggle. Should we register them? Should we keep them contained? Should we this and that?
Right. And the problem with that is, of course, you go, well, they're human beings. They're people.
Right.
You can't, exactly. You don't do that to people. And that's where like the problem arises, obviously. So I don't know, like everything that I think of when it comes to politics, I think is very just in your face, obvious. But what about you, Nick?
I don't know. I think you really hit the nail on the head when you said that with X-Men, like you don't really think about it being like a political book or being something that quote unquote has an agenda, because that's like being oppressed and, you know, is such a core tenet of what the X-Men have been like forever. You know what I mean? Like, it's not something that stands out. Like, that's what the X-Men are.
Yeah, but does it being having politics in it doesn't mean it has an agenda necessarily?
Like, sure, that's sure. I mean, that's just a question of how the agenda is. I mean, I guess agenda is also a loaded word. X-Men definitely has an
agenda of like that we shouldn't repress people and that human rights are equal to all and stuff like that. I mean, sure. Like, I think one of the big things when people are complaining about agendas being pushed in comics and various, oh, well, this is pushing this one view and blah, 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 and I don't like that. Well, and it's because when it's stuff we agree with, we don't notice it or we like it. Whereas when it's something that's against our viewpoint, we're like, this is bad.
I don't know. I mean, I think there's a difference between, like I said, I think agenda is a loaded word, and I think maybe worldview is more, here we go, like semantics, right?
Okay, but, tell us, English major. Hit us with it.
So I think there's that, and, you know, Grant Morrison mentioned this in these quotes that I sent out.
Okay.
Basically the idea that there's no harm in maybe having a balance of views, and I think that that's sort of more important. I don't know. I think we can all agree that we don't like when a book gets, even when it's something we agree with, we don't like when a book gets like preachy. And I think there's the difference between writing. Good writing, yeah. And bad writing.
Yeah.
And knowing writing. how to convince people of things, how to make a good point, how to bring people over to your side without making them even aware. And I know this is sounding like kind of like subterfuge or like sneaky, but like this is the art of persuasion, people. Yeah, that's what this is.
Yeah.
This is no different than, you know, when a politician gets on stage and tries to convince you of his way of thinking. It's no different. There are good ways to do it. There are effective ways to do it. And there are ways that when people can sniff out what you're doing, like, you're done. Like, they might come away from that even more staunchly against whatever you're trying to espouse.
I think you'd be really hard-pressed, Nick, though, to find a comic where the author's intention is to get people who don't agree with them to agree with them. I think mostly people are writing a story to entertain. Sure, and that's just
because you know your reader base, right?
Yeah, to speak to what's already inside their readers. So people don't go around getting non-compliant tattoos because they're such a huge fan of that. It's because the comic's a fan of something already in them. You know what I mean? It's a celebrating something that already exists. It's like, why?
I don't know if I agree with you there. And here's why. Okay? Like, if you read, and this is not to typify readers, but for example, if you read Bitch Planet, for example.
Okay.
Bitch Planet's user base. Why am I saying user base? Bitch
because Planet's it's a readership. Drug, Nick. It's readership. A drug.
you know, their readership tends to be fairly aligned and consolidated in terms of the views that they espouse. I think right? That's not true for any hard book. To argue. Well, no. Here's my point, okay? Whereas I think with something like Batman or Superman, you have these readers that are lifers, and they've been on these books forever, and it doesn't matter who's writing them. And I'm not saying this is a good thing, or it doesn't matter what views or what political aspirations or what social ideas that they put on the character. These people are going to read this book forever, and I think that there's a real opportunity there when writers get on these books to say, you know what? I know you're going to read this book unconditionally because you love this character. And because of that, I know that I actually have a chance to interact with a reader base that might not agree with me, and I actually have a chance to convince people.
Oh, I see what
and
you're saying. And
on the flip side of this, this is why you get those readers that get all mad when they say, oh, Green Arrow would never do this, you know, when he, you know, attempts to interact more with the poor or, mm-hmm. or like the homeless in the Seattle, you know, Green Arrow would never do this, or Green Arrow would never become like a social justice warrior. So I do think you have these opportunities with these characters that are bigger and larger than life to say, you know, hey, readers, I know you love Batman and I know I love Batman, but I want to, you know, talk about some different issues, and maybe they agree more with Batman than you'd think. And maybe that's something you need to evaluate. I don't know. That's me hopped up on caffeine. So
it would be interesting to hear what actual authors have to say about like that. How conscious was that as part of their decision to write about that particular thing versus this is an interesting and topical story? Because political struggles are the issues and conflicts of the day, which are then what ends up in all forms of media, because it's what people are thinking about and caring about. So I get what you're talking about. Like when Green Lantern did their Brother's Keeper arc, where they had the hate crime against his sidekick and stuff like that, and people were either upset or really happy and about that this was a thing and that got addressed because it hadn't been addressed in comics before.
But isn't that a sign of like a very diverse readership then? When you can split your readers to say like on an issue like that.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. As I see his point, because this is a main line and therefore it had some people that were one way and some the other. But at the same time, I don't think, I mean, it, like I said, it'd be interesting to see what authors stay. And I was sure it's not the same for every author, whether or not they were like, I'm going to write this book because I want to change the hearts and minds of the readers that don't agree with me versus this is interesting topical issue. And I think it would make an engaging story. You know, this is, you know, a thing I've been thinking about and that other people are thinking about. And here's how our characters would deal with it. Because I think that's, especially for the Capes, there's so much of that where it's like, this is a current thing. And if you go back and look at, you know, the stuff in the 60s and the 70s, and it's just, it kind of comes through into all forms of media, whether it's comics or TV or movies or whatever. So,
yeah. And I also think on some level, I think some of these authors might be subconsciously, you know, permeating their voice and tone and their ideas into,
I don't think it's subconscious. That's kind of the point of being a writer, isn't it? Like, you want to have a
well, no, what I'm saying is some of these people might not be sitting down and saying, you know what, I'm going to, you know, teach those conservatives a thing or two about, you right. know, the medical systems and the social support structures of American
yeah.
politics. You know, they're sitting down and saying, I'm going to tell a story. And naturally, I'm bringing my tone and my voice to it. And maybe I spot certain character traits in Bruce Wayne or Batman, or maybe there are certain ones mm-hmm. that are more interesting to me. Certainly, if you look at compare Scott Snyder with Frank Miller in terms of how they think yeah. Batman is, and you know, people will say, "Oh, this is my Batman," and no, this is my Batman, and it's fascinating to have these characters over decades and decades, where different writers and even politicians and big people in society on the whole have said, you know, Batman is mine. No, Superman, you know, is for me, and things right. like that. I don't know. It's fascinating to me. I find that just so interesting that all these different people from all these different places with all these different ideas can like claim that this person is theirs, so to speak, or he's in their corner. I don't know. It's yeah.
So I kind of broke it down so there's the comics about political struggles or issues of the day that are true stories, like the memoir type stuff like Mouse and Persepolis. And then there's those that are fiction but are based on real stuff, like Sheriff of Babylon and Queen and Country. And I think the based on the real ones, though, it would be really hard-pressed to find one of those authors, at least the ones I've read. This is a total generalization because I've definitely not read tons of them, but that they're not trying to make a point about the particular political circumstance they're talking about or writing about, rather.
Sure. They're just telling their own story.
Exactly. Yeah. But they have a very distinct point, like this is futile, or this is, we're asking too much of these people, or this or that. You know, there's some.
In Mouse, it was the Holocaust is bad.
That's right. Drove that point yeah. home really hard. Cats yeah. are evil.
If you were on the fence, I'm just kidding. That was terrible. Xander cut that. I'm
Nick sure White's someone will going to hell.
yes.
And then, so then you move from those that are based on real stuff to those that are based on, that are complete fiction, but are examining real power systems, mm-hmm. such as Bitch Planet or Watchmen. Vote Loki is a great example of this. Animosity, I think, could be easily argued to be one of these. And then there's those that are more like a lot of the Capes, I feel like, are just like more, what are we going to build this thing around other than a big guy invades from space? I know.
Right.
They could be mad at each other. Someone could try right. and control someone else, or who's going to be the team leader. And that's where you get all these who should regulate who and who should lead who and who should be in charge. And I think those are probably the least political of the political books, if you will. But I would still count sure. those as being politics and comics. the most pop culture-y one out right now, of course, is Civil War 1 and 2.
Yeah. I mean, comics forever have been, you know, you guys get on that side of the field and we get on this side of the field and it's you versus us. You know, really, that's it.
We're going to go to this airport and punch it out.
Yeah. I mean, comics are just inherently conflict. So what do you want?
But I think the difference is, are we looking at conflict or are we looking at actual politics inserted into these comic books? Because I don't think that we have anything... with history notwithstanding, with in terms of like registration of human beings, you know.
Oh sure. Well, X-Men has been used as a parallel for homosexuality and AIDS and all these other things, whether it's intentional or not. I mean, like there is definitely. I think you can't start talking about one group being oppressed by another without having some pretty obvious parallels.
Right, and I think and that's what we use like these stories to. Say, like, we can get through this as a group. We can find a resolution that is peaceful, or hopefully it can be peaceful. And that's the thing that I always admired about the X-Men is a lot of the times they'll say, we don't have to fight. And then the villain will go, oh, but we do, you know, and then they fight. And it's, you know, it's action-packed comic books and everyone likes a good fight between characters. But at the end of the day, like, there's always that moment of, we don't have to fight. We don't have to or go out there and try to stand our ground that's going to end up with a lot of people getting hurt or possibly killed.
Right.
And
the idea that nobody wins or there's nobody wins when it turns to fight.
Right, because even after these types of fights, usually that's not the end of the conflict ever. Usually the end of the conflict has to come when the enemy or the antagonist says, okay, I realize that you beat me in the thing that I thought I could beat you with, and now I'm going to succumb or I will run away, you know? And it's kind of unfair, but there usually is some sort of resolution. There is usually some sort of good at the end of the day to say, you know, we won the war on both the battlefield as well as on the, you know, mental field or whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
Yeah, which that makes sense.
Which is why I think it's so interesting when you look at something like Civil War II right now. Like, you know, there's talk of all this, you know, they're taking things to court, and I think we're seeing more and more of that, of Marvel Comics or other just comic books in general trying to say we don't have to do a fight to resolve this. We should actually try to utilize the legal system that we've been avoiding for the last 40 years of continuity, you know? Like, the legal system actually exists.
Daredevil's popular again. Bring him back. We need him in the courtroom.
Put him in the courtroom, yeah.
Well, that's...
People like She-Hulk now.
I think that's fascinating, especially when you examine certain heroes and certain characters, how much certain characters are like, you know what? Like, I feel like we can still make things work with the legal system, or I still believe in, you know, the American judicial system or whatnot, like... Or even just general support structures. Like Batman, in some ways, I would argue, is inherently political in the idea that he, if you look at like Arkham Asylum or whatever, he believes, you know, criminals can be reformed.
Yeah,
he believes people can be rehabilitated into society, much to the chagrin of people who then break out and then kill more people. But people forget that that's kind of inherently a political statement about like... the support structures of American society, or how, you know, Daredevil feels that people perhaps should get their day in court before he goes and beats the shit out of them after, you know, the court turns out to be
maybe
a bit crooked. So it's always fascinating to see where and how these heroes interact with government and governing structures that already exist. And how there are heroes who say, you know what, like, all of this is corrupt and none of it's working and it's just me and my gun and also I'm the Punisher.
Right, that's exactly what I was thinking.
You're all going to die.
Those become kind of a venting against structures, don't they, and power structures. And it's more of like this fantasy escapism that can be really cathartic to read because... if you're just so frustrated with stuff. And
yeah, I mean, there are books where the heroes, you know, obviously are, you know, the system is so utterly broken that there's no way we can rely on it, and sometimes those books go on to say, well, maybe it just needs to be rebuilt, and maybe we need to just start at the beginning. But then again, there are, of course, the books that say just everything is broken. It's always going to be broken. What is life? I love nihilism. And this is the way things are forever and ever. Amen. And
so
some of those books are also kind of oddly cathartic where you're like, I don't trust anybody ever.
So you did read Transmetropolitan is what you're saying.
yeah, basically.
I mean, and that's like the
you will never fix this.
Yeah, that's the like weird part about it is that you see this issue where there are books where they try to be so realistic to say, like, as much as we fought and as hard as we tried, at the end of the day, the system is still the system. And unless we are willing to completely dismantle it, we cannot win. And I think that that's the most realistic answer that you can get. There's no way we're going to undo the entire governing system of the United States. Right. Like, and we're speaking strictly from like a Western United States like perspective, saying that we're not going to just say, well, let's upheave the government and start from scratch, because that's just not realistic. And so the books where they do actually do that, and they end with, and then the new king was reinstated and all was good with the world, are almost they're so far from the truth that you realize that this is just a work of fiction. There isn't really much to learn from this in the end. Maybe you learn some things along the way, but ultimately there was no realistic outcome. And that kind of stinks when you're trying to look for a story that can give you a realistic outcome, or maybe try to tell you this is the way that we can fix the world or fix this problem or fix this thing. And it's almost depressing when they do fix it, because you're like, that's not actually how this would work, if that makes any sense.
Right.
I don't know. Like, there were things that, like, there's an article that Nick posted about, I'm kind of jutting to a different part of this topic, but he sent along an article about how crazy comic books were back when Margaret Thatcher was in power, and how a lot of comic books just harped on some of the things that she did, and it became so, like, important to the culture around those comics that, like, politics became a part of the comic book itself, even though it was there are comics that weren't about politics. You know, like Constantine, for instance, isn't really a book you'd think to be about politics, and yet
it was Hellblazer.
I meant Hellblazer.
Splitting hairs. I apologize.
Yeah, that's fine. Saying. Hellblazer is not really a book you'd think to be about politics, and yet that book had a lot of stuff in it that was political, simply right. Because, like, that's what the writers wanted to talk about, because it was so important to them. I mean, we run into books where the politics get inserted right into the book, and that makes it a good story in some cases, because you're seeing this in real life, then you're seeing it in your fiction, and you're getting that escapism saying, here's how someone would fix the problem, or how they would address the problem, but they're not in a position to do so, so let's just kind of read about it as a possible scenario in a weird way.
I think, too, part of it when you're talking about politics and comics is, like, there's a lot of issues that show up in comics are the issues that the youth of the day care about, because, I mean, specifically, like, young adults.
Yeah.
And that's where you get a lot of stuff.
People are probably reading a lot of these comics.
Exactly. And so I think when, I mean, that's true today, too. And so I think comics, although you could... I have no idea what the breakdown these days of who's actually buying comics. I think it's actually trending older, isn't it?
That's the thing. I mean, that's what's interesting is the big reader base. I mean, that's not to discount all the new readers mm-hmm. that are showing up now, but if you want to talk about the vast majority, you're just looking at that big group from, I think, 20 or 30 years ago. They're just getting older.
So
that's it.
Yeah.
But it's still
it's less
that group.
True today then, I guess. I don't know. I know there's discrepancies in how they're counted, though, too, because people are, like, looking at who's buying physical copies,
oh, sure.
And then it's like
it's pretty haphazard.
Yeah,
in different ways.
And who,
yeah.
Versus trades versus digital, science. And as soon as you count in digital, that skews pretty dramatically to younger and more female and more diverse. But anyway, the point is that then I feel like a lot of political issues too is when like people comic book, you know, the main demographic, which again may or may not actually be the main demographic anymore. You're reading comics when you're also starting to care about the wider world around you and, you know, what's outside your high school. So, and getting your own opinions and separate from your families on various issues and deciding what you agree with and what you don't. And I think comics can be a really good way to explore that. And so it's topical and interesting to readers and also, you know, productive, if you will.
Right. And comic books also offer a vast array of left-swinging opinions in a way, but they are also a way for you to, you know, get out of your comfort zone and potentially read something, you know, that is not in your wheelhouse, which is something
I'm
I think we talk about a lot.
I'm going to have to back you apart here, Mike. So, I mean, it depends on what you mean, but I think when you talk about really specifically, like you're talking about, like, oh, this is an obvious politics and comics thing, but if you're talking about just, like, political ideologies that show up in comics, you'd be pretty hard pressed to say. I mean, it's definitely getting better, but I think the majority of the stuff that's showing up on shelves is still mostly for guys, about guys, about, you know, we're here to save the females and to gaze at the females. And to, so I don't think that saying that it's mostly left-leaning now is fair or true.
I think that there's a difference in those two things. When I was saying that a lot of the topics in any comic is typically like left-leaning, I think, in my opinion. But at the same time, comics also has the opportunity to offer to expose you to things that you normally wouldn't see. I think comics are, while they're not like the most prevalent in terms of diversity and such, there are still books that are diverse and could open your eyes to something based on, you know, you look at these books that are critically acclaimed, you walk into any comic shop, I guarantee you that a lot, you look online, and I think a lot of comic book shops will try to lean or send you towards those types of books, right? Because they're so new, they're so interesting, they're getting top reviews by people on the internet, by people who are actually at New York Times, things like that. So if you walk in and you say, just give me something that's good, I have no preference, I'm not going to tell you anything, you might end up with one of those books.
Right.
You know, I think that there's a larger opportunity there than there is in prose or in movies or anything else at this time, because there are so fewer comic books being published than anything else. But I don't know, maybe that's just me. I'm very just hopeful and optimistic about the future.
I think a big shift too was when we got the internet and you could start publishing your webcomic, and that was quite the equalizer.
You're not limited by what your store stocks anymore. Right. You can go online, get 18 million opinions and buy a digital book.
Well, that, and you're not limited in who you're, you know, the white guys in suits at the top will decide to hire you or not. You know, you can go on and you're like, whatever, I'm going to publish this myself, and go online you know, share your comic. And
I guess what I was trying to say is that despite that, I think that there's like a more liberal leaning type of mentality with comic books. I think that's just kind of how media tends to lean.
Okay.
I'd be hard pressed to say that I could think of a book that has like extremely heavy conservative values pushed throughout the whole book. But maybe that's just on some level that has to do with
mature content on some level, like in terms of presentations of sex and presentations of violence. Obviously, stereotypically, people feel that left leaning or more progressive people are more okay with consuming that content, I think. Whereas,
oh, you mean like less religious right?
Well, sure. I think that's conservative right in general, but...
Well, no. There's a big difference between conservative right and religious right. Conservative politically means you're for small government.
I think conservative right maybe will still consume the violent side of that, but maybe not so much the sexuality side. And I think maybe, and don't quote me on this, Mike, maybe I'm taking the words out of your mouth, but when you say things are left-leaning in some ways, it's possibly just the idea that in terms of the more, I guess what you would call mature content that's showing up in books, that's maybe more like left-leaning.
Sure. I mean, I just mean like if political ideologies are inserted into a book, they're more likely to be left-leaning, I think. I don't know.
It'd be interesting to see a study on it. Someone out there who's doing your senior thesis.
I mean, yeah.
Please let us know. I'm making a very broad generalization here.
Offhand, Mike, I'm trying to think of what was the last like right-leaning ideology book I encountered. And yeah, I'm not really... I mean, Judge Dredd is kind of, but it's a satire. That's like the whole point of that one. So,
yeah. I mean, and
I do think it's something there
that we definitely have to do a little bit more research on before we can make an actual statement. I'm just kind of making a generalization here.
I think there are other topics that we can turn this into other, you know, shows, really, honestly.
This one episode, I think, you know, can only cover so much.
I want that one listener to write in and be like, actually, I did this study back in 2007.
Oh my gosh, I would send you so many comic books. I would be so happy. You would get all the free digital comic books courtesy of my wallet.
I think part of it that we might need to be aware of and point out too is that there's that self-selection bias where maybe it's
absolutely.
Perfect example, the other day in my online book club, because I'm a total nerd, someone posted a thing saying, can anyone recommend any female fantasy authors? I realized that you know, it's so hard to find them. And I realized I've only ever read, you know, male fantasy authors except for this one person. I'm like, what the are you talking about? Like, there's so many female fantasy authors. And like, most of what I read are female fantasy authors. And then I realized that's because the books I'm reading, I prefer when the main characters are kick-ass female. And so that, of course, is mostly written by female writers. But it's that kind of, you don't even really realize it. And like, this is what's showing up on my, you know, suggested list. And this is what I'm finding when I go and look at the store. And so you don't really think of it. And then, so someone else out there was going, yeah, there's barely any fantasy, you know, female fantasy authors. And I'm going, what?
That's all I'm getting recommended for
exactly.
some reason. What is up with that?
That's like 99% of my fantasy reading list is female. That's probably not true if I really looked at it. That's probably more 50-50. But still, you get the point I'm going for is if that's what you're into and that's what you're reading and that's what you're liking and there's certain creators you're following and stuff like that, then I feel like it's very easy to get very, like, especially I've found that with myself when people are talking about how few women are in comics and stuff like that. I'm like, that's like 90% of the creators I follow are women. I'm like, oh, well, that's kind of the point, isn't it? Like, it's you're self-selecting. And then, so that could be part of it, too. So an actual formal study. Come on, listeners. We're counting on you here. One of you's got to be a data scientist.
If not all of you.
That's right. Well, so my sister's husband, my sister also got married recently. And he's a data scientist.
The nerd.
And I once asked him, like, so what's a day at work like? He gave me his job title. I was like, what? And then he tried to explain stuff, and I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry I asked.
I sit in front of an Excel spreadsheet all day, and when you punch the number in, it changes the number on the other sheets. And when those numbers change, oh boy, you have no idea what'll happen next.
Yeah.
When you go over to the graphs tab,
people that you ask, you know, like, I have this huge mega load of data, and I want this one question answered. And he writes you a statistical equation to figure it out. And I'm like, oh,
so
math
cool.
brains, I'm glad we have you.
Cool.
But that's
so cool.
Yeah.
I want to be a data scientist.
Oh, it sounds super boring when described.
Oh, it's exact. Like I'm like romanticizing this idea of like this super action packed scene of just like punching in numbers and data's getting crunched, and then we cut to a server room and like there's a fire and someone's like, he's processing too much data, and everyone's like, yes, I will figure this out. Like he's suddenly evil now, and like he's trying to figure out the ultimate question, and then you know the servers melt down, and they're like, we'll try it again tomorrow.
When actually it's more like you spend the last 2 months codifying write-in answers from 50,000 alumni, and they're like, this isn't even a real answer to the question.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things from my understanding of how that type of science works.
Mm-hmm.
It's like
the montage
you're building
version
this incredibly,
of it.
Like you're building this incredibly fragile house of cards structure that at any moment, if you pulled out the wrong card, the entire thing could collapse and be pointless with your output. And since
it
takes so much time to kind of crunch all these numbers and information, you have to be very precise about how you're writing your formula.
Well,
and if
the
formula is off by
written,
a little bit, exactly. It's insane. Insane. Yeah. I mean, I'm only going off of the one course that I took in college about this, but it's wild. Wild stuff. I'm going to write that comic book.
Can we talk about xenomorphs now? I don't like this topic.
Hey, aliens are frequently used as an example of to be like the stand-in for the scary other, which is also a political thing in comics. So,
see, the thing is,
oh, sure.
You've told me about all these crazy, weird, one-off alien stories, Nick. There's got to be one about a xenomorph that, you know, crunches data to kill predators better,
right?
Like, that has to be a thing.
I've analyzed
his
weak spots.
There's an engineer that makes a fully robotic alien.
Perfect.
In order to sneak the alien into the queen's hive and blow it up.
See,
I mean, I guess
that required artificial intelligence, which is a form of data science, which, boom, gets us right back to what we were talking about.
If you want to talk about alien as an advocacy point for women and roles of science and technology and whatnot, you'll find no better place, honestly. All of these female characters that are engineers or scientists and just alien. That's all I gotta say. It's you can be writing a paper about any topic and just rope in alien and just be like, it's weird and it represents, like,
is that how you got through college?
Subconscious sexual stuff, and it's about violence, and it's about whatever war you want to make it an analog to. And honestly, I was going to rope it into this discussion, because if you want to talk about government and the military and corporations just becoming super uncomfortable bedfellows with each other, that's basically what Alien is. I mean, Weyland-Yutani is more or less running the show, and it's a future that we need to desperately avoid. So anyone who can break up these corporations so that Weyland-Yutani or that company from Terminator that I can't
Skynet?
Think of.
Yeah.
Skynet. Like, we can't have these things happen. This is political, and that's what we were supposed to talk about.
See,
and that's my excuse for bringing up Alien and Schwarzenegger movies.
Thank you, because when I think of the future, all I can think of is that alternate, you know, future from Back to the Future, where, how many times can I say future, where Biff ends up like running the world, or at least part of that city. Yep. And it's like an analog for Donald Trump. I mean, we had to throw Trump in discussion. Boom, drop the mic. Episode over. Done.
Whoa. Didn't someone get their first mic? Wasn't that me?
No.
Vote Loki.
No.
Is totally,
yes,
all about,
yeah,
Trumpism.
This is about Trump now, so it's not about facts. It's not about looking up the history of who did what first. Mike got the last word. That's so Trump, Mike. You're so Trump. I'm so proud, like, of you.
Hashtag so Trump.
Kate thinks she got there first. Hashtag
Trump
sad.
So hard, that shit cray.
That's the episode, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast. Our host and producer is Mike Rappin, and the show is edited by Xander Riggs. Special thanks this week to Kate Scotchless and Nick White. The music in this episode is brought to you by Young Bay and Infinity Shred. You can find more of Young Bay on Bandcamp at youngbaybay.bandcamp.com. That's BAE. And, as always, Infinity Shred can be found at infinityshred.com, as well as on Bandcamp at infinityshred.bandcamp.com, where the first track of their upcoming album, Long Distance, is available for listening. If you enjoy this show, tell someone about it, rate us online, or write to us. Email us at ircb@destroythesaib.org, and tell us about some of your favorite examples of politics in comics. You can ask us questions and comment on each episode on our subreddit at ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. The entire podcast team is on Twitter, and you can follow the show at IRCBpodcast. But a great way to experience the podcast and listen to our back issue bin of episodes is to visit us at our website at ircb.us. Until next time, from all of us here at the podcast, thank you for listening.
So whenever I think of your job, Mike, I just see the Hackers movie, you know, where they're in there, so we're like diving around in the system, and
you're
there's
not,
codes
you're
everywhere.
Not wrong.
That's exactly how
I
it
will,
works, right?
Let me tell you a little secret. All of the passwords to our servers are God.
Oh my God.
Sorry, that's a deep cut from that movie. You know, that guy who was in Hackers, he was the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
He showed up in two episodes, maybe three episodes of that series, The Night Of, on HBO, and I lost it while Kelly and I were watching that movie. I don't know why. I was like, holy shit, it's the bad guy from Hackers. And Kelly was like, she's like, so? I was like, I haven't seen that guy do anything in years. She's like, Mike, he's really not a focal. Like, he's a pharmacist in the show. He's not even important in the show. But I was fucking
he's in it for like a
losing
minute.
It.
Like, what the hell?
They had a very good Viagra joke in the show, and I laughed. And Kelly was like, it's not that funny. I was like, but it's the guy from Hackers.
Mike's like, are you going to support his livelihood or not?
Yeah. I was so proud. I knew that. I'm that kind of person that watches a TV show or a movie and go, hey, that's the dude from this who did that. Or that's the woman who was in this.
Or the worst part
is
that
you can't
figure out
what
he's from.
The guy from that one thing, and then you don't even know enough to do an IMDb search.
No. See, that's Kelly during the show. Me, on the other hand, I'll go, oh, you mean that person who is in Hackers? And she's like, oh my God, Mike, really? Or The Wire. Everyone's from The Wire, so I'm just like, that guy was in The Wire. She's like, I don't care. I don't care. This is a comedy. I don't care if he was in The Wire.
Mike, we get it. Everyone was in The Wire.
What I'm trying to say is I'm awful to watch movies and TV with if I've had a beer or two, because I just turn into that guy for the whole movie.